Hello, Jane. Thank you very much for being on a very well-known podcast, the Angry Victorians podcast. It's quite a large deal now. I'm pretty sure we're not far off getting a blue tick. Just wondering, so you're obviously recently come to light as a little bit of a social media influence at some point, commentator, etc. Your background, you've come from a communist country and have a bit of a knowledge with oppressive governments and that sort of thing. How do you say your last name?
Agatan. It's a silent G.
Agatan.
It's a silent G, and it's a Turkish surname, so let's just leave it at Agatan because otherwise it's going to get too complicated.
Yep, cool, no dramas. So can you tell us a bit about your story, how you ended up being in Australia?
I came here in 2004 as a skilled migrant. We left around the same time when Putin came to power. My mother, who's was a vice principal of my school, and she was a history and humanities teacher. She specialized in teaching about totalitarian regimes. And when he came to power, she said, we need to leave the country because we're going to end up living in a military dictatorship. And looking at the news coming out of Russia, I think we can all recognize that she was right. So I came here as a skilled migrant, and I worked as a chef in commercial kitchens and fine dining. And yeah, I fell in love with Australia and I never really looked back, never wanted to return.
Cool. So are you still a chef now? Or what are you doing now then?
No, now, long story. After traveling Middle East and working in Middle East, I was working at a language school as a teacher, and I was in travel space for a while. I came back to Australia and I realized that I do need to get an education in order to succeed in life. And I put myself through uni. I graduated at the age of 31 and I am a chartered accountant. So yeah, that was quite a different journey. So really enjoy what I do and not looking to change it anytime soon.
So you don't miss being a chef or anything like that? When you say you were a chef, were you a chef at like McDonald's out the back?
Probably it was a good introduction for a young girl like myself. I was 19 at the time, to what it's like, what a hard slog is really like. I worked 80-hour shifts and I think I had one Saturday off in about 8 years to go to a wedding. But it's a very hard gig, and it's not family friendly, and lots of love and respect for our hospitality and entertainment isn't great either.
I'm pretty sure Jamie Oliver would say that he gets paid pretty well. So now that you're an accountant, like, what do you specialize in?
So I'm sort of at a more senior manager, associate director level. I oversee a fairly large team of business service accountants. We have an audit component, we have financial and wealth planning component, we have very medium to small business. We do compliance, which is your business activity statements, tax returns, financial statements, all sorts of indirect taxes. And personally, I oversee the workflow. I make sure KPIs are met and I manage processes and change manage for the practice. So that's my role. On the client side of things, I oversee quality assurance. So I review every financial statements that go out have to go past me. So I'm a gatekeeper, and I get involved in complex advisory audits and unfortunately dealing with government of Victoria.
Cool. So you'd be in a pretty good position to know a bit about the government. Just wondering, with the, like, since you've been in recently and you've seen a spate of new taxes come in, has there been many taxes and compliance things that have come in where you've thought there's probably no real reason for that? Ah, lol. And welcome back, Jane. Thanks very much. You're welcome to the B Grade podcast again, where we have four different interviews to try and patch them together to make one. In relation to my last, I was just wondering if you had any insight in relation to new taxes and things that we've brought up, and any of the, a lot of people will complain about red tape that the government puts on top, which is obviously compliance that you deal with. Is there anything recently, for example, that you think is there that is literally just to raise money?
The tax that makes my blood boil is payroll tax. So when you employ someone, not only do you have to pay superannuation, work cover, all sorts of on costs on top of their wages, as well as remit to pay as you go withholding tax to the tax office, you're also punished by creating workplaces and giving people jobs. So payroll tax, not my favorite, but what is absolutely mind-boggling that the government that locked us down and provided us with no supports, no assistance, and didn't help the small people, have now whacked in a mental health surcharge, which is additional half of the percent on your taxable wages that gets lumped in with your payroll tax. I think it's just absolutely laughable that the government is punishing large businesses who employ people, trying to get funding for mental health that it already should be supported, not only supported, but prioritized following the pandemic. Not a fan, and there is no end date on this, so we just continue paying that. Stamp duty, which is huge. On an average house, you'll be paying 60 grand to the government just to purchase the house, and then they bang on about cost of living. In my view, there should be further reduction for first home buyers, single parents, and people who are vulnerable and people who have struggled. I know many migrant families like that. They have saved for decades for their deposit, and now they have to pay stamp duty. So in my view, that's not very supportive of home ownership. And last but not least, a vacant home tax. I don't agree with a lot of government introduced taxes. This one is just laughable. If I purchase a property and it's my choice to leave it vacant, I should not be punished by Andrew's Labor government for my choices.
And podcast take four. So we might skip the tax part because obviously people are trying to shut us down here. How did you get into social media, and was it something that you thought that would take off the way it has?
Absolutely not, and I would probably consider myself more of a de-influencer than the influencer. I don't follow algorithms. I post absolute random stuff that I like, that I find funny, or that I find beautiful or worthy of sharing, and I just share moments of my life as they unfold, and I think that's what people like, because it is genuine and it's not scripted, and I don't come across as a, you know, our robotic elected representatives who are reading off the script. The reason I started my socials was probably mid-2020. I volunteered for a local council for a couple of years. I was on the committee. I really, really enjoyed getting involved, and, you know, my background in finance and, you know, management made me think for some stupid reason that it would be a good idea to get involved and put my hand up and run as an independent candidate. It turned out quite dramatic, which I'm not going to go into details. A lot of people know what happened, that I was targeted by the Labor Party, and it ended up with death threats. And now I have a court case charging a person who's threatened me with criminal offense. But I've only started my Instagram for that purposes, to support my campaign, because, as you know, we were in hard lockdown, and I think part of those extensions were to make sure that people cannot campaign or letterbox or campaign in person. And it was, in my view, done with an agenda to benefit the incumbents. Because candidates had no way of campaigning in 2020. We couldn't even letterbox.
And this is just for local council. Like, why would Labor be involved with a local
unpaid
council?
Unpaid role, I think, and I'm in touch with a lot of people in politics and a lot of people locally, because this is where I live and work and raise my family. A lot of people who were no longer on council, who served as mayors in the past, they said this was the dirtiest and most brutal local government campaign. And for me, I see it as a public service. I make good coin. I don't need Instagram or politics or any of that. For me, I see it as me volunteering my time to help my community. And councils don't get paid. They get the expenses reimbursed. I think I worked it out. It's below minimum wage. So you get $15 an hour for your commitment, for donating your time. So the fact that it was so dirty, dramatic and competitive just goes to show that people don't go into these roles to benefit the community, because my opponent had spent $70,000 on a campaign for an unpaid role.
Mm-hmm.
So
it almost seems like it comes across like it's a like a work experience sort of scenario where you can see what you can do, and then a bigger party will then say, thanks for doing good work for us, and then you can jump in. Like, is there any sort of stepping stone mentality in council?
I think I can only speak for my local council, which is absolutely stacked with Labor and Labor-aligned members, some very clearly aligned, and they were ran in the election as running mates or, you know, a mechanism for collecting preferences. A couple of people got elected where they didn't want it and they didn't expect it. And one of them is my local councillor, sadly. He has been invisible, hasn't done anything. Yes, they turn up to their Monday Zoom meetings, but I think the stacking of local councils, this is where the systemic problem with corruption begins, and everyone's aware of some high-profile scandals with property development. I don't believe people fundamentally go into these roles to help their community, and that makes me sad and that makes me angry.
I mean, you speak about scandals there. I've done a bit of trawling through the Insta page of yours. You mentioned Adam Somyurek at one point. Do you think Adam is a villain or a hero at the moment? Like, he's obviously been called out and now he's saying a whole bunch of things, but I mean, he could have said it at the time, you know.
It's not an uncommon story on either side of politics. I think it's just the way nobody attempted to cover it up, and it was just done in the broad daylight, knowing full well that this is a breach of multiple internal Labor policies and constitution, and just basically signing people up, paying their membership fees so you can control the electorate, then you control the pre-selection, and then you get your mates pre-selected, and then the mates owe you favours, and this is how, unfortunately, in Victoria, politics operate. I don't see him as either a villain or a hero, but I respect the fact that he turned up to vote against a state of emergency. Undemocratic, most undemocratic piece of legislation that I've seen in the Western world, that was rammed through the parliament on the last sitting day, despite staunch opposition from members of community. And you all remember people flooding the streets of Melbourne. I was there personally. I got pepper sprayed, and I had five women with newborn babies standing next to me. It was like a little nursery next to parliament. That goes to show that these people are not right wing, you know, crazy, whatever we were labelled. These are everyday people that disagree with dictatorship. And I think Adam certainly made a name for himself. And I hope that he can continue in his capacity as an independent and doesn't align himself to Labor, because Labor is toxic in Victoria.
Another thing that I noticed when I was going through was IVF. Which was obviously a bit of a hot topic during the pandemic, how it had been shut down. And now that Dan Andrews is saying that he's going to give away free IVF, do you think that this is going to work and people will just forget the fact that he did stop it for 2 years?
This was, as a matter of fact, Labor's 2018 election promise that was not delivered. Now they're trying to ram it through and say, oh, we're opening the clinic. having a closer look, it's only going to service a tiny proportion of population that's obviously needs access to these fertility services, and there are stringent, you know, I'm trying to think of a word, you have to tick a few boxes to in order to qualify. So in my view, is that a step in the right direction? Yes. Is it going to serve?
There's just certain things you're allowed to talk about, apparently. So potentially we're not allowed to speak about IVF as well. This is, what are we up to, number five? Do you want to carry on with that IVF, or do you want to move on to something else, Jane?
Let's try something
a little bit more simple. Whilst also trolling, I noticed that you have dirt bikes and you have a classic car in there. Are you a car or a bike person?
Oh, look, I was going to go for the license, for the bike license, and then I figured that I'm a single parent and I can't really ride my Harley with a seven-year-old in tow and bag of groceries. So I think that's going to go in at some later point basket. I love cars. Probably, look, if I can have a V8 Mustang, I would have it tomorrow.
Well,
sorry, the environmentalist.
I was going to say, but obviously you're going to run that on ethanol and other clean biofuels.
I'll just carry a bunch of solar panels behind me. But no.
Well, that'll make you net zero, as long as you've got a big truck behind you with a solar panel.
Recent energy crisis in Europe and people are not being able to charge their EVs just goes to show that sometimes old technology that still works is more reliable. So I'll stick with petrol vehicles for now.
Well, yeah, this is just another issue I have with government where they're looking at it. It's got to be one way. It's like, we need to have electric cars, and that's the only outcome here. When you've got other people who are making hydrogen cars, like, why are we not investing in that? But you've also got stuff that can fix the current situation, where if we upgraded engines to be able to take ethanol and biofuels, you'd also be curbing emissions. Like, the government gets one track mind, and that's it.
I agree with you completely, Chris. And I remember somebody built a prototype in Australia that runs on used deep fryer oil. And having worked in hospitality, we had a service provider that would come and filter our oil and take away the old oil and replace the oil. So I think there's definitely possibilities there. Unfortunately, they're pushing this agenda without taking the time to think, and I don't pretend to know anything about, EVs or environmental sustainability and technology behind it, but I've read the research that says very clearly there's not enough metals in the world that could be mined to produce lithium that is required for the batteries. So I think we are shooting ourselves in the foot before we even begin on that journey of being, you know, net zero, which is not achievable.
Well, I remember seeing years ago, before electric cars came in, there was hydrogen cars. There was a BMW one, I'm pretty sure, at a motor convention I went to. That was like 2010, I'm pretty sure. So I find it strange that we're not looking at other ones. But, I mean, that brings me into COVID, and insert podcast getting shut down again here. But, you know, like, we worked on all these vaccines and things, but at no point was anyone working on treatments. And now you see in the Herald Sun recently, there's 12 new treatments that they're looking at using, which are all old things. And after speaking to Jay Bhattacharya, he was saying the same. He's like, why were we not working on vaccines and treatments? But if you have a treatment, you then lose your ability to have an exemption under the TGA, etc. So, I mean, as much as I hate jumping on conspiracy theories, it's just very strange that you can have, we're not working on any of the treatments, but we're only working on this, and the outcome for vaccines is only allowed to happen if we don't have any treatments. And what they just, it just seems to be very hand in hand when you see how much money was exchanged afterwards.
I know in Russia, on the onset of COVID, I still speak to a few people that live there, there was a very, very expensive treatment available, probably to a small proportion of people who, upon getting COVID, would admit themselves into a hospital. And I think it was an antiviral drug or a drip. And a few family friends who are in their 60s, they're quite wealthy, they were able to afford it. It was about $1,000 Australian, which is a lot of money for an average Russian. So they, after receiving that treatment, they felt significantly better and they recovered a lot quicker. So I agree with you, Chris. I think the handling of pandemic was very poor, particularly in countries and states that are run by left-wing government. They shown us that they don't know how to handle crisis.
It was, Ruby was in at the Lib Dem gala the other night, and he was saying that he has been to other countries like Saudi Arabia and that sort of thing, and they were, at least they're overtly obvious with how they run things. Like, they don't chop and change how they do things, whereas Western countries are very much like freedom, 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 freedom of speech, freedom of the individual, freedom of all these things, until something happens, and then you realize how they can just be taken away in a second as soon as somebody decides they don't mean anything anymore. And it's a very interesting concept where you're like freedom at all costs until this happens, in which case you've actually got no freedoms and we can take whatever we want away whenever we want.
Absolutely agree. I had this recurring conversation at the gala that having grown up in a communist country where there was no rights, no freedoms, no private property, get that, you could not own anything. So we owned nothing and we were quite unhappy.
That's not how the slogan goes, Jane.
Another country. You couldn't leave the country. You couldn't go to church. You couldn't go to mosque. So we had no rights and freedoms. And I kept saying to people that growing up, I feel like I had more freedoms than Victorians did in 2020 to 2022. What completely blows my mind is that how many people went along with it, and that how many people to this day, despite all the evidence emerging and the fact that there was no health advice and no science behind anything that Victorian government had done, or I should say one person had decided to do, was justified, and that was the right thing to do. That's, to me, is just...
That's one thing that kills me. Is it?
I can't.
Nobody seems to be up in arms about the fact that the health advice has not been released. You know, like 2.5 years of our lives just taken away, shut down, all these crazy rules that they've put in place, and they've still not said why. In which case, what happens next week when they can just do it? And you're like, well, what's the advice? You're like, I'll release that in 72 years or however long it takes to declassify whatever information it is.
Yeah. And based on my experience with this particular government, it will be a heavily redacted document that will be dumped on someone's desk on a last sitting day before they go on a Christmas break, and effectively swept under the rug. So I feel like it's our duty to highlight those instances of injustice and gross breach of all possible human rights. And it's just not on. It's un-Australian what this government has done.
Yeah, I find it strange because it's not like we were at war and we're hiding the names of spies or undercover work we were doing or whatever else. It's literally doctors coming together and discussing issues, vaccines, possible ways forwards, how we can stop the spread, et cetera, et cetera. Like, these are all things that should have been discussed publicly so everybody knew about them, so we were all on the same page. You wouldn't have people storming the streets being upset about their human rights being breached if they knew why. And the fact that it's after we created a whole new committee to, I don't know, appease people, even though it's just been a token thing that we've given somebody else extra money for to be on that committee. You know, if anything, we've just spat in everyone's faces by paying the same ministers that we had that weren't doing their job to then oversee other people still not doing their job and still not releasing anything. So I just wonder when Australians will go away from she'll be right to it's not right and we actually need to fix it now.
People have not suffered enough. That's my opinion, Chris. And you see people who lived under oppressive political regimes, such as myself, people who fled communism, people who have come from the Eastern Bloc. They could see where this was going back in 2015. That's why that explains our issue with Daniel Andrews in particular. We can't vest the power of decision making in one person. This is the reason why democracy exists, and the fact that one man was calling the shots, and when held accountable, he simply stated that he cannot recall who made that decision that put us all in longest lockdown and caused unprecedented and unnecessary loss of life. The fact that this man would call the shots but not take responsibility is another thing that I strongly disagree with. And I think every person in the state really needs to have an honest chat with themselves as how can I live with myself after the last 2 years, and how can we put trust in any government, let alone Labor government, after what they've done to us, which was just heartbreak all round.
I think it's probably also highlighted the systems that are in place even just behind the election for me, like the group voting ticket, where people are making deals where they then potentially owe somebody to vote their way, which then gives somebody powers of being able to run a pandemic the way they are. I think it's also brought up the fact that if you're going to vote for an individual movement sort of party, you need to realise that they are willing to sell human rights as a trade-off for whatever else it is they might gain in the long run, whether it be sex work or Brumbies or whatever it is. If that's their main priority, they will obviously sell the state's human rights out as an expense. So I think if people are throwing their vote away and they're looking into a minor party, maybe look into what they stand for a bit more. Absolutely. Than just going, I can't be bothered with the big two. I mean, you've obviously been the Lib Dems.
The list of names of MPs who had voted in support of a state of emergency so people can cast their vote wisely. I completely agree with you that the crossbenchers that sold out Victoria, the only reason they got elected on 0.08% is the fact that they paid $50,000 to a preference whisperer who lives on the boat in Sydney Harbour, who had them elected, because individually they have no guts, no policy, no vision, and frankly, I don't believe in single gender parties. I don't think they should. I don't think they should be occupying that bench in Parliament, and I'm hoping people will remember who enabled this government to put them in lockdowns and who voted to support this legislation. And now they're getting the favour returned to them by pushing the agenda that is not relevant to 99.9% of everyday working Victorians, families and businesses.
Just with the other things with the system in play, do you feel... like how could we change things up? I was just looking at like compulsory voting, for example. Do you think compulsory voting is good or bad? Like it seems like a money earner for the government from where I am.
A number of people have made comments on my content saying they've never voted and they're in their 50s.
Mm.
So if they've never been enrolled to vote and never voted, then they can't be penalised or fined by Victorian or Australian Electoral Commission. Majority of people are of an opinion that elections are rigged, and a lot of people questioning as to why we're voting with a pencil.
Mm.
That can be very easily raised, but in response to this, I encourage people to actually attend scrutineer training and volunteer as a scrutineer for the candidate of their choice. How we can change things up, I think fundamentally, it's going to be painful next 10 years, COVID recovery. There's going to be a lot of bloodletting in both major parties. I will be posting a list of Labor politicians who are not, who have left since last election or who will not be contesting. And it's quite a long list as well. So, as a person who manages KPIs, one of my KPIs is retain my staff and keep my staff happy and get things humming. If I had 60% of my practice quit in a very short period of time, I'll be in trouble. And ultimately, this is what happened with the party, which tells me that people, despite their very generous remuneration of about $250,000 or whatever they're getting, plus pension, plus all the perks and expenses paid, people don't want to continue with the Labor Party for more than one or two terms because Maybe because they want to sleep at night and have a clear conscience. Who knows?
That's a pretty crazy concept. The
unlikely.
Well, it's funny that like if you're losing 60% of people, if you were at VicPol, you'd say that you'd trained people well, and that they were using those skills to better themselves and the rest of the world. When other people would be saying, if you're losing people at a rate of 2-1, you're doing something wrong. You're either not training them right, so they can't handle the situation, or you've made an environment that isn't conducive for people wanting to hang around. But
it is toxic, and I think we can all agree the way Daniel Andrews speaks to the media, the way he talks about women, the way he would refuse to pronounce an opposition leader's name in the lead up to last election. It's gaslighting, toxic leadership, and ultimately the party is going to implode. That's my personal feeling.
Have you had many people reach out to you from any sort of like regional issues, like the AusNet towers or people with water rights or any of those things?
I probably have a few people I know from Geelong area and a few people from Western Victoria. Throughout my career, I looked after a lot of primary producers and cattle farmers in those areas. And I know they're Liberal and National voters through and through. They would never consider supporting the government, who only considers Metro Melbourne in their policies. Sadly, none of the policies and promises coming out of pretty much both major parties have nothing to do with helping people of regional Victoria, who are, and a lot of people don't realise it, a bloodline of our community. They grow our food, and if they're in trouble and if they can't have access to affordable water, then we don't get to eat. We have to buy our meat from another country, which is laughable because Australia has the best produce, Australia has the best cattle, and we should be doing everything we can on the policy level to look after our own as opposed to importing food that we can perfectly grow ourselves.
Well, I'm pretty sure we're exporting all our gas and then importing that back as well, so it's not a one sort of thing. Again, the government's pretty keen to sell as much stuff as they can and then buy it back at an inflated price. So when you've been working with them, have they, like, how does, do you know how any sort of water rights comes out of it? Like, have you seen what they're paying for the right to use water on their land?
Yeah, bushfire period. Sorry, I'm just going to start my car because my phone is running out of battery. But I'm in a secure car park for those who are wondering, those who are, continue to report me to Victoria Police. The message is loud and clear. Calm down. But look, I'm not gonna speculate about water rights because it's not my area of expertise. I just think that it makes sense if you are committing your life to working on a farm and working the land to produce food that you then sell for next to nothing to a supplier or wholesaler or supermarket, that you at least are looked after by the government and given the rights to use your own water at no price or very little price. But provided the decision of Daniel Andrews Labor government not to build any dams back in 2017 because climate change, and provided the floods that we have that people will be dealing with the consequences of for weeks and possibly months to come, we can already see that this government cannot be trusted to look after regional Victoria because they only know inner city. They don't understand regions, and they are not willing to work with the communities to understand what communities want and address those issues, in my view.
I had a it was an interesting thing that the Libs and the Nationals were talking about, where they've started terming, they've got metro, regional, and now country. So they've sort of accepted the fact that they're only going to speak to metro, and now they're starting to speak to regional, but regional only stops at Geelong, Ballarat, Melton out my way, and then probably Pakenham would be regional out east, but then Gippsland and Mallacoota and, you know, Shep, et cetera, are all still going to be ignored because now they're termed country. So they can say metro and regional and still mean they're ignoring a lot of people further out. So it's sort of interesting when you see terms start changing. It was like when anti-mandate turned into being the same thing as anti-vax, like anti-vax. Like people need to start watching when people start changing the terminology of what things mean, I think, because it usually means afterwards somebody that's now been excluded is going to be ignored. Why aren't you running for politics? I take it the council has left you a little bit jaded on the system?
All I can say is that I've been approached by multiple parties and multiple offers, so not ruled out, and watch this space. I just don't want to be given any Labor soy boys a heart attack too early in their campaign. So let's just see what unfolds. But I am considering a number of options. I just have to figure out where my efforts will be best applied.
Would you look at running upper or lower, or are you not allowed to talk about this?
I will not be, my mouth is sealed at the moment.
Okay.
Let's keep it a big surprise, and it's mm-hmm. probably not going to be a very pleasant surprise for the Labor Party, and yeah.
Okay. I mean, you must be allowed to say Labor soy boy, otherwise it would have been cancelled on this podcast for the fourth time. unless you've got your aircon on your car maybe now. what else have we got? Do you have any family still over in Russia, and are they able to actually get out to you and speak to you about how they are, or what sort of restrictions are in place?
Elderly relative who doesn't quite walk very well, and she's completely, I would say, zombified by the state media. We have half of our family in Ukraine who moved to a remote village following the events of 2014. One territory has now been occupied and one territory remains under Ukraine. We have no means of contacting them because they live in the village and there is no phone, you know, no landlines. And when I asked my Russian relative to get in touch with them and make sure that they're okay, she said, but they told us on the news that Ukraine is blocking all the calls from Russia. And I just left the conversation there and then, because it's very difficult to speak to someone who's been subject to mass brainwashing for many, many years. And it's very difficult to change their mind. And this is not something I'm capable of doing on a phone call. So situation overall is probably at its worst. To my knowledge, Russia had conscripted or recruited 225,000 people and sent 16,000 so far to fight with their brothers, and all Slavs are brothers. And if you look throughout the history of Slavic countries, we don't invade our neighbors, we defend our motherland. And I know people will fight to the last drop of blood to defend their village, but we're not going to go, and it's not part of our culture to go and invade the next door village for no reason. I don't think a lot of Russian people support this war. I don't think people want to die in this war. And I am of an opinion that Putin may have very serious health issues or mental health issues, because from the get-go, there was no strategy behind it, and it's resulted in unprecedented loss of life on the Ukrainian side. Cities being turned into rubble.
Can't talk about it. That's how it works. That's how censorship works on this thing. See you later, Jane. Welcome to the show. Welcome back to the 6-part series of talking with Jane and being shut down for whatever reason it is we're going to shut down. I'll let you go, Jane. Your phone's probably going to explode, and I don't know if the feds are coming past to see you or whatever it is, but I'll wrap that up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for speaking to us when we've asked you, and it was really lovely to see you at the Lib Dems gala the other night. I will. We'll speak to you later. Thanks for your time. Oh, she's gone again, is she? And that's it. See you later.
thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your time, and best of luck.